Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Randy Shandabel, formerly the political editor at KTVU-TV, currently a media and political consultant for my own communications company, and I'm your moderator for today's program. This program is being held in association with California Forward. Our focus today is the confusing and seemingly untenable state budget process in California. You will also hear the results of a new comparative six-state study with great implications for California. In June 2011, then New York Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch and former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker assembled a task force to examine threats to near and long-term fiscal sustainability in six U.S. states: California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Texas, and Virginia. While these states obviously differ in many ways, including politics, policies, economies, and demographics, they share many of the same problems. Though the extent varies significantly state by state, there could be no doubt that the magnitude of the problem is great and extends beyond the impact of the financial crisis and lingering recession. In July of this year, the State Budget Task Force released its findings, which highlight these major threats confronting the six states I just listed and other state and local governments across the country as well. Those threats: Medicaid spending growth, federal deficit reduction, underfunded retirement, eroding tax bases and volatile tax revenues, local government fiscal stress, and state budget laws and practices that hinder fiscal stability. Now, today, we are joined by a prominent panel that will address the issues raised in the report. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. To my left, George P. Schultz is a member of the State Budget Crisis...
Usually on your right, but actually I'm on your left.
How do you know that? How do you know that?
He knows everything.
Mr. Schultz, you obviously all know, a member of the State Budget Crisis Task Force Advisory Board. He's served as U.S. Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of Labor, and Director of the Office of Management and Budget. Secretary Schultz was chairman of President Ronald Reagan's Economic Policy Advisory Board and is now the Thomas W. and Susan B. Ford Distinguished Fellow at the Hoover Institution. Also, he has been awarded the Medal of Freedom. Do you want me to stop?
Yeah, stop.
I can go on. The only thing he hasn't done is played center field for the Giants, but he's contemplating doing that soon. David Crane is a lecturer in the public policy program at Stanford University and president of Govern for California. He is also a member of the State Budget Crisis Task Force Advisory Board. From 2004 to 2010, he served as a special advisor to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. And from 1979 to 2003, he was a partner at Babcock & Brown, a financial services company. Mr. Crane also serves as the director of Building America's Future and California Common Cause. He previously served on the University of California's Board of Regents and as director of the California Economic Development Commission. Carol Denniston is a partner at Schiff Hardin LLP. She has provided bankruptcy analysis and counsel to clients for more than 20 years. Currently, her practice is focused on municipal restructurings. Ms. Denniston played a key role in the drafting and passage of Assembly Bill 506 that requires municipalities in California to participate in a neutral evaluation process before filing for bankruptcy. She frequently advises lenders and borrowers in distressed commercial real estate restructuring transactions and often advises private equity clients on bankruptcy risk and restructuring. And Lenny Mendoza is a member of the California Forward Leadership Council and director at McKinsey & Company. He is also the chairman emeritus of the Bay Area Council and chairman of the Economic Institute of the Bay Area. Please welcome all of our panelists. We will begin with some opening statements from each panelist. First, we will start with Secretary Schultz, who will talk about his involvement and the importance of the task force.
On August 4th of this year, I was a proud participant at a wedding of a grandson of mine. While people were gathering, another grandson played the guitar and nice music. And in the wedding party, a granddaughter came pulling a little red wagon in which were two great-grandchildren. And you sit there and you have an experience like that, and you say to yourself, the only thing I should be thinking about now is what kind of a world are these kids going to inherit? And is there anything that I can do to make it a little better? That's the ball game. So I've been interested and worried about budget issues a long time, having been director of the federal budget. But I certainly have been concerned about what's happening in states and localities. So when Paul Volcker and Dick Ravitch invited me to take part in this effort that they've led very ably, I was glad to do so. Because, with all due respect to the big issues that our federal government deals with, we live in communities, cities, states. This is where we are. And this is, in many ways, where the level of government is most important to us. Just a couple of numbers to bring this point home. All the states in the United States together last year spent $2.5 trillion out of money. In California, it was $230 billion that were spent. We have 6 million kids in the K through 12 system. There are 3 million in the combination of the California University, State College, and Community College systems. So these are big numbers. And this is where we live. So with all due respect to the federal programs, what's going on in California? It's not a good picture. It's an odd thing that happens in the political process. People love to spend money. That's a bipartisan statement. When I was director of the budget, I was getting rolled all day, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I got a little weary, and I was talking with the old timers that have been there a long time, and I said, really, is there any difference between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to spending? And he took a deep breath, and he says, well, they both spend money, but the Democrats enjoy it. So, but when it comes to spending, it's there. And when it goes unchecked and unnoticed too long, it can get us to a point of no return. Or to put it another way, where there's just an explosion and all kinds of bad things happen. We can see it already in what's happening to our wonderful California higher education system. Gradually, it's being starved for funds. Probably a campus like UC Berkeley can make out all right as a private university, in effect. Their state funding is now very low. But other campuses don't have that big alumni gathering, and they're not going to do so well. And our community colleges, they just do so much. And I could go across the board on these things. But I think we have to wake up and say to ourselves, let's look at this, at where we are, which the task force has done. Where we are is not pretty. And we decided as a task force not to get into the business of making recommendations for what should be done, but rather focus on the problem with the feeling that once people grasp the problem, and the fact that it's not to do with our recession that's been going on. It's a deep structural problem. And if we don't cope with it now, it'll do some very bad things to us. So that's what the task force did, Paul Volcker and Dick Ravitch. They're very experienced men, and they did a careful, thoughtful job and try to lay out the picture. No holds barred, no wishful thinking, just hear the facts. And now, to develop the realities more, I'd like to turn to David Crane, who had his nose rubbed in this problem, trying to help Arnold Schwarzenegger unsuccessfully get a hold of this problem. So why were you so unsuccessful, David? You can explain this to us.
Thank you for that introduction, George. The program will be abbreviated today. It's been a great honor to serve with George on the task force. And I'm going to speak for a little bit longer because I have to play Dick Ravitch's role today as well. Dick would have loved to have been here, but it didn't fit perfectly with his schedule. Just 4 years ago, Americans learned that even the most senior government officials did not understand the extent of obligations undertaken by the Wall Street firms that they regulated. Even the most senior officials of the firms themselves did not understand the extent of their liabilities and obligations. We all saw then the consequences of incomplete financial reporting. In that case, the consequences were a panic that threatened the very foundations of our economy. 6 months after that collapse, Dick Ravitch assumed the post of Lieutenant Governor of New York State, after a long and highly successful career in both the private and public sectors, including shepherding New York City out of its financial collapse in the 1970s. After arriving in Albany, Dick learned that New York State's finances were afflicted with the same head-in-the-sand mentality. Neither state officials nor third parties, such as rating agencies, understood the full extent of state commitments or the consequences of those commitments. Of course, the consequences are very different. With the global financial crisis, the consequences were immediate. With state governments, the burn is slower, more like a frog slowly being boiled to death, as more and more services are cut, even as taxes rise and even as economies recover. But both situations emanate from the same basic cause, a failure to expose financial truths and consequences. And they have in common an excessive and irrelevant reliance on rating agencies. In the global financial crisis, investors relied to their detriment about the safety of certain securities and institutions. With states, rating agencies look out only for bondholders, but not for junior and priority service recipients who get funded after debt is serviced, such as public colleges and universities, welfare recipients, parks and recreation centers, mass transit, courts, and more. Or for taxpayers. Or for future generations who will require sufficient net revenues for their own services and their own infrastructure. For example, what rating agency pays attention to the fact that even though California state revenues grew more than 50% over the last 10 years, state spending on the 33 University of California and California State University campuses that serve more than 700,000 students declined by 20%. The fact is that no one is looking out for service recipients, taxpayers, or future generations. Down the hall from Dick sits his longtime friend Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, who, like Dick, understands the critical importance of truth in financial reporting and the central role that state and local governments play in people's lives. So Dick and Paul resolved to form a task force to understand and communicate the full extent of the fiscal problems faced by states. They made it nonpartisan. Prominent Democrats like Joseph Califano, the father of Medicare, and Alice Rivlin, the budget director for former President Clinton. Prominent Republicans like George and Nick Brady, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary and U.S. Senator. Academics like Philip Clay of MIT. Budget experts like Dick Nathan, Mark Shaw, and Peter Goldmark. And accounting-obsessed Democrats like me who worked for a Republican governor. They got funding from independent parties on all sides, George Soros on the left, Pete Peterson on the right, and many others in between. They hired the best, such as Don Boyd, who took a leave from his job at the Rockefeller Institute to serve as executive director, and Ed Dasev, an advisor to President Obama and Vice President Biden, who chaired the California report and who's here today. Don could not be here today, but we're also joined by Pat Fuchs and Haley Rubinson, who did tremendous work for the task force. They targeted six states: California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Texas, and Virginia. Not intentionally, but nevertheless symmetrically, three states currently run by Democratic governors, three states currently run by Republican governors. They involve top-tier experts within each state, such as Jim Mayer and Fred Silva of California Forward. Jim is here today, but Fred unfortunately could not be here. They assembled the first report of its kind, one that reports the totality of the problems faced by states. And what they found is the following. One, spending on Medicaid, pensions, and retiree health care is growing at rates that exceed any reasonable expectation for revenue growth. To give you a sense of that math, just consider the recent pension legislation passed in California. The state announced that that reform would save between $42 and $55 billion over the next 30 years, which is a significant amount of money. But what they didn't announce is the context in which those savings will occur, which is that the state expects to spend more than $600 billion on retirement costs over that same 30-year period. And reputable third parties project the state will spend more than twice that amount. Two.
But when do the states, when do those savings start to occur?
Towards the end of that 30-year period.
That's the point.
So even so, whenever they occur, it's at most 5 to 10% of the totals that will be spent. Two.
Yeah, but the point is people are always doing things where the price is going to be paid by some guy 10 years from now, not today.
Right.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that reform largely affected new employees. It did not address the current unfunded liability. Two, state and local governments are finding it harder to raise revenue because untaxed transactions are diminishing the sales tax base, gas taxes are eroding, and income taxes are more volatile. California is a prime example of the latter because of its reliance on so few taxpayers earning capital gains, which are taxed at ordinary rates in California. And of course, in California, we have Proposition 13, which acts like a ceiling on local revenues, even when a majority of voters in a local jurisdiction would vote to raise those revenues. Three, local governments are facing equal or even greater pressure than states, some reaching the point that San Jose Mayor Chuck Reed calls service-level insolvency and what an East Coast mayor terms social and cultural bankruptcy, which happens when cities cut services to the bone to meet the demands of creditors. Those services include libraries, mass transit, garbage collection, street cleaning, vehicle maintenance, road repair, parks, community centers, rec centers, and more. And then, when those cities have cut to the bone and they have to decide between paying police and fire or paying creditors, they declare financial bankruptcy, like Stockton just did. Four, with federal deficit reduction a near certainty, likely cuts in federal grant dollars and potential changes to the federal tax code further threaten state and local governments. The federal government provide states more than $600 billion per year. As I'm sure Lenny Mendonca will describe shortly, the impact on California from just a 10% reduction in federal dollars would be huge. Five, state budget practices, such as treating borrowings as revenue and not disclosing all costs, obscure truth and make fiscal stability all but impossible. For example, California is proposing a $50 billion tax increase, on which I express no opinion, over the next 7 years, but does not disclose how it intends to address a demand from the state teachers' pension fund that would consume half of that tax increase over that period. As anyone who read the New York Times this morning about Chicago's teachers' pension fund knows, teacher pension fund deficiencies are all too often ignored until it's too late. With such inadequate information, our legislators and citizens are flying blind, no different than those financial executives and regulators 4 years ago. Because the task force's principal goal was to inform, and because each state has its own political dynamics, recommendations were limited to procedures those states should undertake. Specifically, one, adopt far better accounting and reporting services. Two, plan budgets over much longer terms. Three, plan for federal deficit reduction. Four, account and clearly and truthfully for retirement promises. Had they done that before, we wouldn't have this problem today. Five, develop stable revenue systems and utilize rainy day funds. few people realize that California's economy itself is relatively stable. It's the tax system that's not stable. Now, for the more detailed report on California, I'm pleased to turn it over to Lenny Mendonca, chair of the State and Local Government Practice at McKinsey and a member of California Forward's board. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I would strongly encourage anyone who is interested in a thorough, serious, although sobering look at California's budget situation to read this report. It is a terrific report and gives a very clear and precise description of the challenge that we've got facing us. The findings and conclusions of the State Budget Task Force for California are actually very consistent with the themes and conclusions of work done by California Forward. Task Force and California Forward have worked together to help create and help to ensure the implementation of some budgeting practices that hopefully will address some of these and importantly renew the trust of the public. First and most importantly, as David said, we must all recognize that we're not simply going to grow our way out of the current state fiscal crisis. For the most part, our problem is really not cyclical. It's much more fundamentally structural. And the sooner we admit that issue and deal with it, the better off we'll be. We have to chart a course out of this problem by spending our money smarter. A handful of things that we think might be an important part of addressing that. First and most important, focus on results. We need to provide a transparent, accountable state government finance system that focuses on results. California fundamentally has to improve its budget planning and fiscal reporting systems. State budgeting practices need to ensure that we focus on our highest priority investments like education and infrastructure so that we can maximize our investment and ensure we have a healthy state today and for our children and our grandchildren and Secretary Schultz's great-grandchildren. Second, we need to extend the budget horizon. We need to think about long-term expenditure commitments by moving to a two-year budget cycle. Budgets also need to include five-year fiscal forecasts for major programs such as education, health and human services, criminal justice and infrastructure so that progress on statewide goals can be tracked. This focus on a longer-term view, transparent and performing accountable government is at the heart of the California Performance and Accountability Act or Proposition 31, which will be on the ballot in November. Third, we need to think ahead about the future. In addition to budgeting, we really need to think about five-year or longer strategic growth and infrastructure financing plans. Integrating the state's economic and demographic growth with expenditure and infrastructure forecasts and then being prepared to invest in them with the right time horizon could provide policymakers and investors with the tools to consider the longer-term economic needs of the state. Fourth, we really need to develop better tools for managing the state's fiscal situation over a business cycle. We need to adopt better use of countercyclical tools like a rainy day fund and repayment of budget-related debt in prosperous periods. The measure that will be on the ballot in November 2014 can help with some of these issues. Fifth, we really need to rethink California's state and local tax structure. We need to refocus our attention on the state and local tax structure to make sure that it addresses the needs of the state. Although many commissions and task forces have come and gone over the last 20 years and looked at this, California must again take a serious look at how we finance our state and local services. Tax reforms at the state level are needed to achieve revenue streams that are adequate, reasonably predictable, and minimize volatility. Sixth, we are going to have to rethink pension and post-employment benefits beyond what was just passed. To increase transparency, pension plans need to account for the obligations they assume in order to disclose the potential shortfalls and risks that they face. Legislators, administrators, beneficiaries, and taxpayers need to develop and adopt rules for the responsible management of pension plans and mechanisms that ensure that required contributions are paid and that those who receive them actually have the money to get. And finally, we need to also monitor closely local financial conditions. We need to improve the monitoring of local fiscal conditions during the time that the state actually has limited capacity to intervene with fiscal assistance. California has a long tradition of a pretty flexible municipal finance system, but with the exception of local school districts, it really has very few effective procedures for monitoring the fiscal conditions of local governments. So, again, I would encourage everyone to take a look at this report. It will give you a good fact-based understanding of the situation. I'd encourage you to think hard about the sets of reforms that I've just outlined and really ensure that we have a government that is transparent and accountable and performs so that we can regain trust in the state and ensure that we've got a great state going forward. With that, let me turn it back to Randy.
Thank you. Carol Dennison, the first question is for you. As you know, several California cities just this summer have gone into bankruptcy, including Stockton and San Bernardino. So my question is, to what extent does municipal bankruptcies, does that affect the state budget crisis? Or is it the inverse? Is it the state problems creating problems for the cities and triggering the bankruptcies?
I think it goes both ways. I think we have a sort of a top-down and bottom-up problem. The economic crisis has affected the municipalities in a huge way, and we're actually seeing the financial stress and distress at that level first. They can't balance their budgets. And then, if just to follow up on your comment, the pension obligations is putting so much stress on the cities that even if they can balance their budget this year, they know that's not the case for next year and the following year. So we end up with a, I think the degree of pain at the municipal level right now is much higher than it is at the state level because they're feeling it first. And unlike a private sector situation where we would do a workout and have things like the ability to sell or raise capital, debt or equity, the municipalities' hands are tied because of the laws in California, Prop 13, the economy has reduced sales taxes, gas taxes, everything that David talked about as well. They're feeling it right now in real time.
So I think there are some people who see these clusters of cities having fiscal problems, and they think that there must be some kind of mismanagement or poor management going on. And you're saying that's not necessarily the case. That could be a factor, but it's bigger than that?
I would say yes and no, and the reason I would quibble with it is that we've had a long history in California of kicking the ball down the road. In other words, every time you have a series of politicians faced with a problem, if it's something that can be band-aided over, it tends to get put off for the next, you know, the next whatever into the future. We have a lot of that going on. We also have the financial transparency and accounting problems in the municipalities, just like we do in the states in terms of books and records. And that was one of the things that we hoped to achieve with the Assembly Bill 506, which was to get financial information exchanged between the municipality and its creditors, pension holders, employees, so that at least they could have a conversation. That's a Band-Aid proposition. A lot of people have called and said, well, why didn't you do more? Well, the bottom line is if you're going to do more in terms of oversight, you have to have money to administer a program. And when 506 was going through the process, the message from the legislature and the governor's office was, if it doesn't cost anything, we can put something in place, but it had to be revenue neutral. So you have what is a functional equivalent with 506 is a Band-Aid trying to cover a hemorrhage. And if you think that you've seen bankruptcy filings this summer, the number of cities that are trying to figure out, should we go into a 506 process is huge. And in terms of state oversight, what are we really looking for? Just like your report indicates, is better education, more assistance with the reporting and supervision at an earlier level, which nobody really wants, but we're kind of at that point. If we don't bring it to a head and deal with it, the actual distress for the taxpayers living in these municipalities is going to be acute.
Secretary Schultz, the national economic recovery has been much slower than I fair to say most people had certainly hoped for.
And the That's an understatement.
Yes, absolutely. And the California economy is a key source of national tax revenues. So could you comment on how the California economy is likely to do in the next few years and whether that could affect the nation's recovery?
Well, I think California is a fantastic place. What a piece of real estate. Wonderful. And historically, people used to come here because the education was so good. And look what's happening to us. I'm down at Stanford, and I live around all these smart people that are creating all this stuff. But you have to say to yourself, looking out over the last 20 years, Latinos, who are soon to be the predominant ethnic group in California, 43% did not finish high school. A little over 10% finished college. So, and You look at places that have done well and you say, it's not the kids' fault. It's the system's fault. So we're educating a labor force that's not going to be able to do the jobs that are being created by all this hot stuff. So the jobs will go elsewhere. So we have some very fundamental problems that are going to affect the long-run prosperity of this dramatically productive state that's got so much going for it. And it just makes you cry out for reform in these processes so that we can get on and take advantage of everything that California has to offer. People talk about cuts all the time. I think a better word is reform. Let me give you an example in K-12 education. Something like 30% of the money we spend in California on K-12 does not go anywhere near a classroom. We have the most centralized system in the country. The most decentralized system is Massachusetts, where the people in the schools, our teachers, are doing what they think is going to do the best. We have a centralized system where people sit around writing regulations on how you're supposed to handle your classroom. And the result is the teachers don't do anywhere near as well as they could. It's almost, this would be a little extreme, but if you did away with that 30% that represents bureaucracy, you'd save a lot of money and it'd improve the quality of education. So I say we ought to look at all these programs around, not with the idea of cut, but with the idea of reform. Make them do a good job, and where they're not really doing a good job, get rid of them.
Mr. Crane, I don't want to put you on the spot politically, but there's a coincidence too big to ignore here. We're less than seven weeks away from Election Day, and we're talking about the budget, and there are three ballot initiatives, at least three, that deal with the budget. I won't ask you to comment on them specifically, but there are three tax issues, and each of them, in an effort to win votes, dedicate all or most of the money raised to some specific popular cause, such as public schools or clean air. And again, without asking you to praise or criticize them specifically, in general, is that a wise approach, or does it end up handcuffing state legislators and the governor?
My view is, in general, it's not a wise approach to have ballot box budgeting. It's one of the reasons California has the problems it has today. And the legislators in California have the power, and along with the governor, to fix all these problems. Tomorrow, the state legislature could address all the problems that really afflict the state, from correction spending, which is about $10 billion this year. We incarcerate more than 150,000 people. We have a legislatively passed law from the 1970s known as determinate sentencing that the legislature could reform tomorrow. That alone was the biggest contributor to California's prison population. The legislature could reform prison guard.
This is reform, reform, reform. That's the point.
Go ahead. And the legislature can do it because all that was legislative. The legislature could reform pensions and retiree health care and compensation for prison guards and others in California. The legislature could reform the tax system in California. So this ballot box budgeting always gives legislators a chance to complain that they really don't have any power, but they really do have a lot of power. The problem is that they don't exercise it, and when they do exercise it, they generally exercise it in favor of special interests rather than the general interests. So I just think if you had 5 to 10 really good legislators, and those 5 to 10 people are probably sitting in this audience today, you could transform California. You don't need these initiatives. And so as a general rule, I don't like them. I think they're harmful.
Okay. The real quick question, you say the legislature has the power. They obviously recognize the problem. So why don't any of them exercise that power?
It'd be a great question for you to ask one of them. In fact, I can pick one out for you. I happen to be a Democrat. Go find a Democrat who lives in the most liberal parts of the state and ask them why last year, 3 weeks before they voted to cut welfare and courts for the second and third times that year, they voted to boost prison guard compensation, with the net result that the state is now spending more than $6 billion on the comp and benefits of a grand total of 65,000 employees in the corrections department, while cutting welfare, while court systems People have to pay for their own court reporters now in California, while higher ed spending has gone down and all the rest. Ask them. That's one of the problems is journalists don't ask them those questions.
Wait a minute.
Well, actually,
you messed around in Sacramento. So
what time is it?
People in the legislature you're extolling, where do they get the money to conduct their campaigns?
The answer is, and the Fair Political Practices Commission published a great report in 2010 called Big Money Talks, and California Common Sense, another organization, does a lot of reporting on this subject. They get most of it from the following groups: government employees, who are by far the biggest spenders. The California Teachers Association spent over $200 million in the last 10 years. The California State Employees Council spent $100 million. Chevron, I think, spent $50 million. Tribe spent $50 million. Pharmaceutical companies spent $80 million. And they end up owning a few legislators. But that doesn't mean that those legislators have to do their bidding.
Well, just a real quick
80%,
aside.
I think the number is 80% of the money that the people who are running for office use to support their campaigns is provided in Sacramento by various lobbying organizations which are representing various special interests. So don't tell me that money doesn't talk once in a while. It does. And that's the reason for the initiative process. People sort of give up on the legislature because it's the prisoner of these special interests. That's the thing that you have to break.
Well, maybe so, but in my view, it's always been this way. I recently read the biography of Alexander Hamilton, and I'm struck by the history of the United States and how much money and influence was involved always in electing people to senior positions, but it didn't always mean people had to do the bidding of the people that provided the money. But, I mean, if money can be gotten out of politics, that's great.
No, no, but there's a particular form
of
money
David show.
That they're up in Sacramento and their cocktail parties given all the time, and that's where all the money comes from.
That's true.
Right there in that little cesspool called Sacramento.
And most of it is raised during, I believe, bill passage and bill signing periods. Your point is well taken.
Just real quick, you asked why journalists don't ask, why don't you do more? And journalists do ask that, and the answer is always, oh, it's the other side's fault. And so that never ends. We try to get beyond that and frequently can't. Mr. Mendoza, one key task force recommendation is to have two-year spending plans in the budget rather than annual budgets. And California Forward is one of the groups pushing a ballot initiative, Prop 31, which would do just that. Last night, the respected Public Policy Institute of California released a poll showing Prop 31 losing badly. So why do you feel so many Californians just don't see things your way, or is the concept too difficult to understand?
So the specifics of that poll were that the vast bulk of them don't know what they're talking about and were undecided. So there's a small number of people who know what the proposition actually is. That's part of the challenge with complicated reform initiatives in an era where there's a lot of discussion around particular candidates or the tax measures. Things that are about the details of budget reform are not exactly getting top-tier attention. So the reality is most people haven't decided what they think yet. Actually, a large portion of the guts of Proposition 31 came from a deliberative poll that was done with citizens in the state of California, where we brought 400 people together last June to a hotel in Torrance, California for the weekend to deliberate on, if you had your choice, you were informed, what would you like? Six of the things that in each case started with approval rates above 55% and in every case ended with approval rates above 70% are at the core of the measure. And those are things like the two-year budget. There are things like ensuring that there are clear goals for government programs and reporting back on those, that they have to actually publish projections before the budget, that you have to adopt two-year instead of one-year budget. Those are the sorts of things that are in there. It's just complicated. That's the problem, Randy.
Okay, I have a quick reminder for our radio audience. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the results of a six-state study on the budget process and how the lessons are applicable to California. Our panelists are George Shultz, former U.S. Secretary of State and Secretary of Labor and a member of the Advisory Board on the State Budget Crisis, David Crane, former Special Advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger,
and a member of the same advisory board. Carol Denniston, partner at Schiff Hardin LLP's Municipal Restructuring Practice, and Lenny Mendoza, member of California Forward Leadership Council and director at McKinsey & Company. I'm Randy Shandeville. Now, here's a question for anyone who wants to take it. I think I know the answer, given what some of you said in the remarks, so if someone can answer quickly. But again, recent big news, Governor Brown's pension reform, a step in the right direction, not enough, a charade.
I'll take that one. Mayor Chuck Reed yesterday was asked that question. He said he was spending most of his time thumbing through a thesaurus looking for synonyms for the word small. And I'm not even so sure it's a step in the right direction, because it may lead people to think something has been done. It's a little bit like climate change. It's like, if you think you've done something to address the problem and you really haven't, it shows up many years down the road and you're in a worse position. That reform didn't come close to what states like Rhode Island, led by a Democratic treasurer, Gina Raimondo, or Minnesota or Colorado have done. And the reason is because California, unlike those states, is unwilling to spread the pain beyond citizens, new employees, and taxpayers. The other people that need to share in the pain are current employees with respect to years not yet worked, and retirees with respect to COLAs. So the math that I described makes it clear it's relatively small. It's a savings of maybe 5%. As George pointed out, most of that even is towards the tail end of the next 30 years. It'll have very little impact on all the services that are being squeezed out.
There's a fundamental problem that we have in this country, and people have all over the world, to a considerable extent because of breathtaking research and development in the United States. We have better pharmaceutical products, we have better procedures, we have the Salk vaccine, we have all kinds of things. And people are living longer and they're healthier. So you have retirement systems that were geared a long time ago to the demographics then, and they just stay in place. Meanwhile, the population grows, and the older population grows, and people live longer. And the arithmetic of the earlier programs just doesn't work anymore. So somehow that has got to get changed. My own feeling is that people have to work longer and maybe change the nature of the work they do. But anyway, work attaches you to reality, and there's a little dignity to it as well. So here I am in my 90s, and I'm still going strong. You can do it.
and still yet to play center field.
Right.
I'll take a couple questions from the audience here. To what extent can the budget process be distanced from politics? What impact does political extremism have on the process?
Other than dooming it.
Well, I saw this firsthand in the Schwarzenegger administration. I think the budget is politics. That's their principal job, is to reach compromises on how the state's going to allocate its resources to its people. And people keep forgetting that in February of 2009, much to the chagrin of a number of Republicans, Governor Schwarzenegger proposed and got a tax increase passed legislatively. He got Republicans to step over and vote, because we needed a two-thirds vote to get that done. And that happened legislatively. Everybody has forgotten about that. Governor Brown could have done the same thing, with the exception that he had promised he would not raise taxes without voter approval. And when in a world like that, and because of the single subject rule related to initiatives, if all you're going to do is put something on the ballot, you can't team it with another initiative relating to compromise or reform. So it's very hard to get that sort of thing done. But these legislators and governors can get it done. I don't think extremism is the problem.
Secretary Schultz?
Procedures can help. And orderly procedures do a good job. Presumably, it starts with the governor making a proposal. This is the governor's budget. He puts that forward. And then committees of the legislature hold hearings about it. And people can express their views. And then they have to come up with a result that stays within some total limit. And it's important to have it be a transparent process so that when gimmicks get too widely used, they get exposed. And it makes it harder and harder to use the gimmicks. But anyway, I think procedural things can, if insisted upon, can help in the process, even though I agree completely with David, after all. That's what the political process is supposed to produce, is a budget which stands for how the state's going to make its efforts.
Another question from the audience, and whoever wants to take it, feel free. Businesses are leaving California in droves. Isn't lowering the business tax rate in California a good idea?
So I'll take that one first. I think it's a function of the structure of the tax structures, not as much as it is the absolute level. One of the issues with people making decisions about California, not just do they come here or do they leave, it's do they increase employment here. And part of that has to do with the nature of the way their incentives are in the tax structure. And so it's partly about levels, but it's also about the nature of what the tax structure actually is. Most of the people who've looked at the tax structure in the state, the commissions and task forces, all talk about trying to make it broader but a little bit lower so that there's less disincentive to grow here. That's one of the challenges of the state tax structure.
Secretary?
I think it's way more than just the tax rate. The regulatory maze in California is not to be believed. Everything, it's almost as though whatever is not required is prohibited. We have a home on the Stanford campus. It's been there for over 100 years. We've owned it for almost 40. And we, getting a little older, if you fall, you'd like a bedroom on the first floor. So we wanted to add a room. There's plenty of land to do it. It took us a year to get permission to add that room. And at first they said, you've got to dig an 80-foot trench, 6 foot deep, all around the house. And then somebody's going to come and see if they can find any evidence in the soil of earthquake proneness. And I said, come on, the house has been there for 100 years. Doesn't that tell you something? And I'm not going to dig that kind of a trench. Finally, I had to settle for drilling holes. And they sample the earth, and it costs, I don't know, $20,000, $25,000 to get all this process done. But it's when you try to actually do something in California that's at all different, you simply can't believe the regulatory maze that's on top of you. And there ought to be some room for people to decide for themselves what's in their interest and not always have to do what some regulator thinks. The regulation is driving people out of California, believe me.
Thank you. I'm going to try to fold in an audience question into a question of my own, and I think this is probably most apropos to you, David. The task force report mentions that financial reports by state governments occasionally present information in less than transparent fashion. Looking at the California state budget for fiscal year 2012-2013 that was enacted into law just this summer, could you give us some examples, specific examples, that show that lack of transparency? And then this audience member asked, are there other states in the six-state study that do have more transparency? Is there a good state model?
Well, I can give you some very clear examples. So, for example, in California's budget for 12-13, included in revenue is $1.7 billion of borrowings, which are because there are transfers from special funds that have to be paid back. Also,
they call that revenue.
They call it revenue, which is the most stunning thing I learned when I got into government in 2003. I had never been associated with an enterprise where a borrowing was treated as revenue, but governments, because they use, this is more than you ever wanted to know, but because they use cash basis budgeting, can treat cash from any source as revenue. Believe me, the Schwarzenegger administration was not pristine about that stuff either. So on the other side, on the expense side, the state is not reporting the full cost of retiree health care. Retiree health care are the benefits provided to state or government employees for the period from when they retire, 50, 55, whatever the age is, to when they go on Medicare, and which is 65 currently. And then there's some supplemental coverage after they're 65 as well. The state is paying for that only on a PAYGO basis. So, for example, your budget this year is showing a cost of $1.7 billion for OPEB, as it's known as. But the real cost you can discover by going down the block from the state capitol to the controller's office, who issues a report every February, and you would see in his report that the real cost is $4.7 billion this year for retiree health care. So the state is actually incurring $4.7 billion of cost, paying partially $1.7 in cash, and the other $3 billion is new debt. That debt, which is your debt, is now up to $61 billion and growing rapidly. Another example is the state, and I made a reference to this because of that Chicago Teacher Pension Fund article in the New York Times today, the state is ignoring the request from the California State Teachers Retirement System for $3.5 billion per year of additional contributions. The State Teachers Retirement System operates under statutory contributions rather than the way PERS operates. They're ignoring it. And STERS is very clear that they need the money, and financial economists, including a Democrat, Alicia Monell at Boston College, says the teachers' retirement system needs twice that amount, $7 billion a year. The state is ignoring that. So you put all this together, the budget deficit is really somewhere between $8 and $15 billion greater than is reported. Other states do the same thing. Chris Christie talks a great game, but he balanced his budget 1 year by simply not making a $3 billion payment to the pension fund because they use cash basis budgeting, which was the equivalent of borrowing money at 8%, but he claimed he balanced his budget. As for other states that do it better, I have to defer to Ed DeSevres or somebody else here, or Lenny. To me, none of them do it well. Anybody who does cash basis budgeting is not telling the truth.
Do you concur?
The accounting issue that David's talking about is consistent across all the states, Government Accounting Standards Board, so they're not reporting it properly. There are other states that are much, much better about transparency and reporting of what's going on, even if they don't account for it that way. Virginia is actually pretty good at that, for example. Among the things that those states that are better at it do are reporting on results, not just what the budget numbers are. Many states do two-year budgeting as a matter of course. There are also states, Washington did this in the past, so it's not a Democrat or Republican state. When they ran into budget problems, they had a much more transparent process with the citizens to think about what priorities were that helped influence that. So it's not just a California problem, but there are things from other states that California could learn to work better.
So has that better transparency in states such as Virginia, does it make a difference? Other than being more transparent, has it helped the budget process there?
It does help the budget process. In California, the same deliberative poll that I mentioned, we asked people before they came in to the weekend what percentage of the dollars that went to Sacramento they think were wasted. Before they came in, they said 45%. After deep discussion, all the facts laid out, experts coming, and a weekend afterwards, we asked them again, what portion of the numbers, the revenues that go to Sacramento are wasted? They said 39%. So, you know, there is a deep distrust about what's going on, and transparency and clarity helps a lot. Sunlight is a disinfectant. Really does help and create confidence if people are prepared to invest. One last example. Citizens, including major business groups, have consistently in the state of California supported investment in local infrastructure bonds. They've also supported investment in local schools that require supermajority votes. Part of the reason for that is they know where their money's going and they see the results that are associated with it. So it's not like this is people are not prepared to invest if the results are there. What they want to see is they want to have confidence and faith that what their money is being spent on is actually being spent well.
Another question from the audience, and this one gets to the third rail, so I don't know who will want to take it. The decline of California's once proud educational system parallels the passage of Proposition 13. Is it time to look at restoring our property tax system? Who volunteers?
I remember at the start of the Schwarzenegger campaign, he asked Warren Buffett and me to be chairman of a little advisory committee. And Warren immediately proceeded to sound off about Prop 13 and all the ridiculous things that it required and so on. So we had a meeting, and then Arnold appeared before his first press conference. It was like a presidential conference, and a huge and intense kind of expectant atmosphere. About the third question was, Mr. Schwarzenegger, your advisor over there, Buffett, is advocating repeal of Prop 13. What do you think? And Arnold turned to Bubby and says, Warren, if you say one more word about Prop 13, you got to do 500 push-ups. And that ended the issue, but it can't be the end of the issue. It's a, but we know why it took place. I don't see why, as a starter, you can't separate individual homes from commercial properties and take that step. That wouldn't have the same kind of connotations as the problem that created Prop 13 in the first place. And so that's something. Why don't we get behind that as a starter?
I think there's a great opportunity. You know, Prop 13 was a disaster, not so much for the reasons I think a lot of people think. And I think actually it could have been, had the state not voluntarily stepped up after it passed in 1978, had the state not stepped up and backfilled the locals, which it did on its own, Californians would have gotten a firsthand opportunity to see what consequences they had wrought by passing Prop 13. But the state stepped in. It's like raising kids. You know, people didn't suffer the consequences of their own actions. I think there's a great opportunity to reform Prop 13. These local jurisdictions are squeezed in a vice right now. You've got costs rising inexorably, and you've got this ceiling. Even if voters wanted to increase property taxes, they cannot unless they get two-thirds vote, which is virtually impossible. But I think it's going to have to be combined with something else, that it's going to give people confidence that their money can't be spent in the incorrect ways. And I know I sound like a hammer hitting the same nail all the time. The single largest obligation that legislators regularly make without voter consent is retirement benefits for government employees, which are no different than promises to pay debt. So everybody in this audience gets to vote on general obligation bonds and decide whether or not the state should issue those. And they've issued about $80 billion because you've permitted that. But the state has issued $500 billion worth of retirement promises that are no different, and you haven't approved any of those. And I think that will make a big difference if people have a say over what legislators will make any promise of the public purse they can get their hands on, as long as they don't suffer any negative consequences. When that gets fixed, Prop 13 can be fixed.
Once again, our panelists today, George Shultz, former U.S. Secretary of State and Secretary of Labor, and a member of the Advisory Board on the State Budget Crisis. David Crane, former Special Advisor to Governor Schwarzenegger and a member of that same Advisory Board. Carol Denniston, partner at Schiff Hardin LLP's Municipal Restructuring Practice, and Lenny Mendoza, member of California Forward Leadership's Council and director at McKinsey and Company. I'm Randy Shandabel. The task force talks about how one of the causes of the budget problem is skyrocketing Medicaid costs. So, question for anyone. I think it's fairly obvious in these times. Is there a chance that Obamacare will make a difference one way or the other, quote-unquote Obamacare?
Well, not according to the administration, the Schwarzenegger administration, the Brown administration, and RAND Corporation. RAND, and you can get the report online, says that the Patient Protection Act, colloquially referred to as Obamacare, will cost the state an additional $2 to $4 billion a year starting in 2016, which was one of the other disclosures I think the state should make in connection with the tax increase it's proposing. So it doesn't look like it's scheduled to save money, but George might have additional comments. There's no evidence I've seen that the state will save money as a result.
Anyone?
Well, part of the underlying elements of the act was the expansion of population, portion of which is borne by the state. So that in and of itself will increase the challenge. Some of that's reimbursed by the federal government. The real question, which has yet to be seen, is what happens to the underlying aggregate cost drivers of health care? That's what's the real question is, will there be really a bending of that curve or not? And that's yet to be seen. Certainly the growth has slowed since the act was passed. That's a factor of a number of things, not all of which are related to the act. We're obviously in a deep recession. People are paying a lot more attention to healthcare costs. Companies are changing the structure of what their benefits programs look like. So the real issue is not what the expansion of the populations look like, which will be extending the cost of the state, is what happens to the underlying cost drivers of healthcare itself.
Another question from the audience. How can we ignore the obvious fact that people's incomes have gone down? Obviously, that means their tax revenues is down. What's the effect of that on the state budget? Or is this structural and bigger than the temporary situation?
Well, I'll go first so everybody else can I can talk off the top of my head, but state revenues are up 50% over the last 10 years. I remind people of that. And there was a tax increase in February of 2009. And the California tax system is largely driven by the income, significantly driven by the income of 144,000 taxpayers. Because 50% of all the personal income tax is paid by essentially 1% of the taxpayers. And their income is very largely driven by capital gains. So the income that has gone down significantly is capital gains type revenue. And that has hurt California's tax collections. That's one of the reasons the state has to move to a different source of revenue. And you know, my own view is extending the sales tax to services would be the way to create a tax system, a revenue system in California that looks like California's economy, which is relatively stable.
Actually, if you did that, you could raise more money and you could lower the rates all around.
Yeah.
And that would be, you were talking about jobs for California, it would provide incentives for people to stay here.
We've only got a few minutes left, so let me ask everyone, take a turn at this question, and you could, you know, have, say, a minute each if you'd like. The task force warns that the time to act is now. So my question is, and what if we don't? If you could each talk about what you think could happen. You're all talking that we need to do something. What happens if we don't? What are some of the calamities we could expect to face in the near future, long-term future? And Secretary Schultz, why don't we start with you?
Well, you're going to drum up the business for bankruptcy experts and people who know how to work out of a problem, because what happens if you just go the way you're going is you're not able to pay your bills, literally. And so then, what is government supposed to do? Government is supposed to give us a lawful society where there are orderly rules. Government is supposed to help K through 12 education and higher education, so we have an educated labor force. Those are the two fundamental things. And the result of this process is you're beginning to force curtail these things. And so what you're doing is you're making promises that make it impossible for the government to perform its functions. And you've got to say something wrong with that process.
David, just real quick, I think part of the problem is that people hear that there's a budget crisis, and they hear it so often, and they hear about it so often that they get kind of numb to it. They hear there's a budget crisis, yet for most individuals, life goes on.
I think that the crisis has already happened. That's why I make a reference to a frog that's slowly being boiled to death, but not sort of being ignorant of it. Tuition has tripled in the last 10 years at California's universities. Welfare benefits are being cut during a recession. Court dockets are extremely long. You now have litigants having to pay for their own court reporters in San Francisco court. So imagine an indigent litigant. Where are they going to get the money for a court reporter? The state legislature closed 70 state parks at one point to save a grand total of $22 million in a year in which the state is levying fees and taxes of $130 billion. Families use parks, and they recreate there, and especially, you know, when they don't have as much money as they used to have. So I think the crisis has already happened. The thing is, no one pays attention to the people that are being hurt. I call them the defenseless ones, higher education. The legislature is essentially privatizing California State University and the University of California systems while claiming that they're not, as I mentioned, the welfare recipients and all the rest. And then they want to raise taxes at the very time when the private sector employees are having a tough enough time getting wage increases and getting jobs. And any tax increase of any sort, I don't care what they say, is going to dampen economic growth. So what happens if it keeps going is the frog gets boiled more and more and more, and people that we care about get hurt more and more and more, and job growth and wage growth gets dampened more.
Carol?
I think from a municipal perspective, it's a tragedy if we don't do something now. I mean, Secretary Schultz is right. It's going to create a lot of work for people like me, but what we don't seem to appreciate yet as a society is bankruptcy in a municipal context is a black hole. We can't fix it. If we can't have tax reform, if we can't deal with all of those other issues to increase revenue, we can't fix the problem. You can bring all kinds of toolkits and restructuring options, but without some reform, you can't fix it. And the people that are hurting right now are the people in all of these small cities that can't balance their budgets, that have already shut their libraries, already shut down all of the extras, and are now beginning to look at ways to reduce police and fire. So there goes your safety and welfare. And if you look at Vallejo, which is a poster child for not the definition of success, Vallejo couldn't balance its budget 1 year after exiting bankruptcy, and it still has a crime rate that's frightening. So you have to ask the question, you know, how do we fix it? We have a multifaceted challenge. We have a political challenge, which you've heard. We have the need to look at this as a business problem, as opposed to all the rock throwing that goes on when a community can't balance its budget. We need to back up and take a look and say some of these are legacy problems, and let's look at it from a business perspective, following a lot of the things the task force has identified in terms of transparency and reporting. And then we need to bring the community together, because if we don't, what's going to happen is you're going to affect the bond market in a way that the municipals are not going to be able to access it. And that hampers the future in much bigger and a lot more complicated ways. So if we don't act, we end up what's essentially with a black hole, because right now everybody thinks that the legal system can somehow fix this, and I'm telling you that that is not the answer.
And unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap it here. Lenny, we've run out of time. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to do that. Thank you to our panelists, George Shultz, former U.S. Secretary of State and Secretary of Labor, and member of the Advisory Board on the State Budget Crisis; David Crane, former Special Advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a member of the Advisory Board on the State Budget Crisis; Carol Denniston, partner at Schiff Hardin LLP's Municipal Restructuring Practice; and Lenny Mendoza, member of the California Forward Leadership Council and director at McKinsey & Company. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with California Forward. I'm Randy Shandeville, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.